Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, last week's insurrection at the Capitol leads the House to impeach the president for the second time in the very chamber that was invaded by terrorists. While Congress dealt with that, Charlotte City Council was occupied this week with the city's future as well as their own. Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris reverses direction on her COVID recommendations. Now she says stay home, and she puts a kink in CMS's back to the classroom plans. Here to talk about all those stories and more is Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, along with Ann Doss Helms, WFAE's education reporter. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning. Glenn Birkins returns. He's founder, publisher of QCityMetro.com. Glenn, good morning.
Morning.
And Eric Spanberg is here. He's the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thanks for joining us, Eric. Good to see you.
Morning, Mike.
It was a mundane-sounding moment in our history.
On this vote, the ayes are 232. The nays are 197. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
So, with those words from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Donald Trump became the first president to be impeached twice and the first to be impeached for encouraging insurrection against his own government. Steve, we knew the Democrats would be successful in this part of the process, and it was a highly charged political moment, so put it into perspective.
So, I think the main thing, the big takeaway, of course, is the only president to be impeached twice. And then the next piece is that there were 10 Republicans nationwide who joined this vote. In North Carolina, it was went along party lines. There were no surprises. All 8 Republicans in the North Carolina in Congress voted no. All 5 Democrats voted yes. The big surprise was in South Carolina, where Tom Rice, who was one of 6 Republicans, voted to impeach. When he voted yes, a lot of people thought it was a mistake. Mm-hmm. So that was absolutely, people in his district are absolutely stunned.
So, as you said, every House Democrat, we'll talk about that a little bit more, every House Democrat voted to impeach. This time, the 10 Republicans joined them. The final vote count was 232 to 197. They had 2 hours to debate this, and it broke down not only along party lines, but using many of the same arguments that we've been hearing time and time again throughout the last 4 years. Congresswoman from North Carolina, Alma Adams, was on this program earlier this week. She made her case for impeachment like this.
He is a very dangerous person, and I just believe that after this assault on our democracy that was perpetrated by him, it was intensified by this president. There's a sense of urgency that we must deal with this right now.
Of course, this came a week after the riot by those that some have called a mob of domestic terrorists. They had been egged on by the president at a rally on the Ellipse. But North Carolina's 9th District Congressman Dan Bishop, who has been insisting the election was illegitimate, which it was not, denied the president incited it.
The law is well settled. Quote, what is required to forfeit constitutional protection is incitement speech that specifically advocates for listeners to take unlawful action.
So, Steve, is he saying that when the president said, we're going to march on the Capitol, and when he said, you have to be strong or you'll never take your country back, among other things, and when he tweeted an invitation in advance telling supporters to come to Washington on January 6th because it was going to be, quote, wild, and when he tweeted during the riot that those participating were patriots, Bishop is saying that is not incitement?
That's what he's saying, yes. And it's an argument that a lot of I think Republicans aren't comfortable with privately, even though many voted not to impeach. But this is really, I think, on the right and among conservatives become this has been their big defense. A lot of whataboutism, right? Where they compare language used by people on the left somewhat you know, over the summer, encouraging people to fight for racial justice, things like that. You know, it's, I think the big safe space is among many conservatives has been just kind of parsing the president's language and kind of not stepping back and look at overall at what happened.
And Glenn.
The other thing that I would point out in relation to that is that in some ways he's setting up a straw argument. Impeachment is not a legal process. It's a political process. Were they to actually try the president in a court of law, whether or not he would actually be convicted would be probably more challenging. But impeachment is not a legal process. It's a political process. So comparing the two is not warranted.
And some Republicans were upset because, well, they claimed to be upset because this seemed to be an attempt to punish the president for a cumulative amount of incitement over the past 4 years, because he has been an unconventional president who shoots from the hip and pretty much speaks unfiltered, both personally and on Twitter. Are Democrats going after him, prosecuting for 4 years of grievances? Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think that, you know, that's going to be a matter of perspective. And also you're trying to get into people's heads to some extent. But I think it's as simple as this. This is the first time the Capitol been breached since 1814. And this time it was at the urging of the sitting president. So that's about as crystal clear as you can be when you need a justification or a basis for pursuing impeachment.
Newly elected 11th District Representative Madison Cawthorn, known for his divisive comments and his tweets, and who helped rev up the crowd on the Ellipse last Wednesday, called for unity during his arguments on the floor of the House, urging colleagues to, quote, vote against this divisive impeachment and realize that dividing America will not save this republic. Has he changed his approach since that vote, gone back to his old habits, or has he remained radio silent? Because some of the things he said prior to that were completely the opposite of what he said on the floor.
I mean, you know, I think I pointed out in the story that, you know, he's talking about unity, and on his campaign website, he's selling T-shirts for $30 that are mocking liberals. You know, if you look at Dan Bishop's argument, it takes a while to unpack, and it has these multiple layers to it. Madison's Cawthorn argument about unity is kind of more of a fifth grade, sixth grade book report argument, I think. But he has he's faced a decent amount of blowback in his district for his actions and his rhetoric leading up to this.
And what do you say, though, Steve? That is, he is not alone in terms of you have had a fair number of Republicans who have tried to make that argument that this is a time for unity. Let's not further divide the country with impeachment. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. It is a fifth or sixth grade book report, but it is a popular fifth or sixth grade book report.
The Senate will get this article of impeachment whenever Nancy Pelosi decides to send it over. But Senate Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he is happy that the House impeached the president and privately has said that this may be the one way they can purge Donald Trump from the GOP, but he also said he wouldn't be able to start a trial until after Inauguration Day. There's an article this morning that says it may start on Inauguration Day as the new president, is being inaugurated. And then, of course, it would fall on Chuck Schumer's shoulders because at 12:01, he becomes the Senate Majority Leader as the House shifts control. If this vote was so urgent, according to many Democrats, why wait? What's the point of waiting? And will they likely have the votes if they do wait and the Senate is controlled by Democrats? Because you need 2/3 of the Senate to convict.
I think that's going to be really interesting to see in terms of will they convict. I think if I were a betting man, I would probably say no. But on the other hand, I think there are a number of people who would like to see the president purged from the party. I think there are a number of people who would like to see him prohibited from running again in 4 years. So it's going to put some people in a very awkward position, having to vote in essence, against their best political interests.
I just wonder if Lindsey Graham can vote yes and no, since we've had such a whiplash of emotions from him the past week.
Well, they played a cut on television last night of Lindsey Graham talking at during the Clinton impeachment, making the exact reverse argument about what he just said this week. And I've forgotten exactly what it was, but he's known for that, for flip-flopping in that area. Ann, you wanted to chime in.
Well, I was going to say, we're going to see events keep developing in terms of additional potential violent protests. We keep hearing that things could happen in state capitals and in Washington, and I wonder if that might affect votes, if we feel like this was not a horrible one-time thing, but a horrible ongoing thing.
You know, politicians are not known for not being hypocritical, but where was the unity when after the evening after the insurrection, they went back on the House floor to vote on the Electoral College votes, and the objections continued from some Republicans? Where was the unity then? All right. A rhetorical question that cannot be answered by anybody on the panel. This impeachment seems to be gaining support among Republicans. I mean, there are Republicans who would benefit from a conviction, among them Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley. If they stay in the party and stay in the Senate, you know they want to run for president in 4 years. And removing Donald Trump's ability to run for president would help them immensely, one would think. But you mentioned Tom Rice a little while ago, Steve. He's from South Carolina. And here's what he had to say, because it surprised everybody.
I wish that they had never brought impeachment up. I think it is a divisive thing for the country. But if they're going to do it, then I had to vote yes. I had to vote yes. I think what he has done is a complete lack of leadership. I think it's a complete failure of leadership. And I think that I think the country deserves better.
That's South Carolina's Republican representative, Tom Rice, speaking to WMBF. Talk to me about Tom Rice. He's really conservative, and he's not ever, I don't think, said much about negative about Donald Trump.
That's right. And he objected to certification last week. So of the 10 Republican defectors in the House, he was the only one who voted to impeach and not to certify, which is a head scratcher. I talked to the party chair, the Democratic Party chair down in Myrtle Beach. I said, okay, if I told you one of the members in South Carolina was going to vote to impeach, would you have ever guessed Tom Rice? He said, absolutely not. Tom Rice's, his view seemed to be, he didn't seem to be focused on the president's actions leading up to the riot. He said, well, maybe he incited, maybe he didn't. His focus was on what he kind of talked about, this lack of leadership as the Capitol was being attacked and how the president kept tweeting and did not really have any forceful call to stand down. That seemed to really bother him or sicken him, if you want to say that. And, but everyone in his district is Myrtle Beach, Georgetown, and some counties north, everyone completely stunned.
Law enforcement and intelligence authorities say we may see a repeat of last week's violence in D.C. This weekend and again on Inauguration Day and the days after that. And they put the top 50 state capitals on notice as well to be on the lookout for violence. What has Governor Cooper done in response to those warnings, Eric?
So he's called up, I think, 550 National Guardsmen. He's sending a couple of hundred to D.C. to help them with the inauguration week. And then he has, I think, 350, not a math major having gone to LSU, but I think that adds up to 550. He's got 350 who are, you know, ready to help with the Capitol in Raleigh, obviously. And as you mentioned, Mike, the worry is that this is going to happen across the country.
When we come back, we'll talk about city council. They were really busy this week at their strategic retreat. We'll talk about what was discussed and what came out of that on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE, the local news roundup with Steve Harrison and Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Jamie Harrison down in South Carolina, before we move on to city council, ran for the Senate against Lindsey Graham. He lost. He had previously served as the chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. But he's not going to Washington as a senator, but he is going to Washington, Steve, as?
He will be chair of the DNC, replacing Tom Perez. So a real high-profile job and kind of a cool gig.
And he's not the first South Carolinian to go to Washington to run the DNC. I can't think of his first name. Don Fowler. Did that years ago. He was also the chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party and then went to Washington to be the head of the DNC. What is it about South Carolina and the National Party?
That is a good question. And, you know, maybe it's if you're a Democrat and you can survive and thrive in South Carolina, then you can make it anywhere.
Well, pretty good indicator, though, Mike, of the influence of Representative Jim Clyburn, because, of course, he played such a pivotal role in Joe Biden's election, and Jamie Harrison used to work on the staff of Jim Clyburn.
There you go. Well, while Congress was handling the fallout of last week's riot and gearing up for impeachment and an inauguration, Charlotte City Council was setting the stage for 2021 and well beyond. On Monday, they held a strategy retreat, but they were greeted at first with what some called a surprise, the resignation of the longest-serving member, Councilman-at-Large James Smudgy Mitchell.
And I realized after the first week being on the job that I could not do both, even though I've been the energized bunny for a long period of time. Being president of a great company and being a city councilman was more than for one person.
He has just taken a job as the head of a construction firm that does business with the city, and initially he said he would recuse himself from any decisions involving that company and the city. RJ Leeper is the company. What led to his change of heart, Glenn?
Well, we heard what he said, but in reality, he could not do both. Not if RJ Leeper was going to do business with the city. He owns 25%, I believe, of that company, and under North Carolina statute, that company could not do business with the city. At the end of the day, I'm sure it was a financial decision, doing what was best for the company.
So did this come as a surprise? I know it was in discussions with the city's attorney about the legitimacy of being able to do both jobs. But last August, he was one of the people who objected to Tariq Bakari, his company, getting a city contract because he sat on city council. So was this really a surprise? Anybody? Well, Eric?
I think it was. Go ahead. You go ahead, Eric.
Just going to say, you know, James had a press conference in the afternoon Monday. And he said at least twice, maybe more than that, he cited the statute by number and said, I didn't know anything about this statute. Of course, I should defer to Steve because Steve was the one that was breaking the story in the past week about the fact that there likely was a very red flag conflict of having a council member who owned a construction company that has done business with the city in the past.
Steve.
Yeah, it was. Throughout his career, Councilmember Mitchell has kind of worked for companies that do business with the city, but he's never had an ownership role. And so when he's just worked for the company, a simple recusal, just to step down and not vote, was always enough. But no, he had never been in the situation of owning 25% of the company. The city had never been in the situation. So he thought kind of the old rules would apply, and they didn't. And like Glenn said, RJ Leeper, they do a really tremendous amount of work with the city, and they kind of talked about, well, we'll just give that up if we need to, but I think there was too much money at stake, and they couldn't walk away.
Eric.
Yeah, I was just going to mention to that last point that Steve made. James said that 60% of the revenue of RJ Leeper comes from city and county contracts, so that's easy math to figure out why he made this decision.
This, however, was the start of James Mitchell's 20th year on council. I think he served 14 years, seven terms as a district rep, was out of office for a while to run for mayor and some other things, and then he returned as an at-large member. The mayor praised his contributions while on council this week. What were they, Glenn?
Well, I think he's done a number of things, especially as it relates to the Black community. He was part of the team that brought the CIAA basketball tournament to to Charlotte, which was here. I can't remember how long, but
15 years.
More than 15 years. Mm-hmm. He brought the Black Enterprise annual expo to Charlotte. I would actually give him credit for doing a lot in terms of economic development. He headed the Economic Development Committee, City Council's Economic Development Committee. He worked a lot behind the scenes to improve the lot of African-American businesses, and not just African-American businesses, but business in general for the city.
So by state law, he has to be replaced. His temporary replacement for the duration of his term must be a Democrat who will serve until next January. And Mitchell has said he'd like to see a Black woman take his place on council. But Mayor Lyles, who was on this program earlier this week that nobody heard because we were preempted by coverage of the impeachment hearings, which you will now hear on Tuesday of next week, Mayor Lyles said that it's up to council to choose that person.
I expect we will have a number of people come in and say that they're very interested in the seat.
Everybody on council will be up for re-election in November, and no matter who they appoint, I suppose they could run again, but one person in particular has made her desire known in this area, and that's former council member LaWanna Mayfield. Any other possible contenders that we know about?
I haven't heard names. I think James Mitchell mentioned that he had five people that he had discussed candidacies with. There was a lot of chatter among council members about a lot of interest, but there weren't a lot of names thrown around. But I bet we're going to know very quickly because they're going to take it up as soon as this week in terms of setting up the parameters.
So at the strategy meeting that they had this week, council also began discussing the transportation recommendations of the Harvey Gantt-led Charlotte Moves Task Force, and they've told whatever committee does this to go ahead with preparations for this. This thing calls for an expansion of a variety of transportation options, including rail. Both the mayor and Harvey Gantt have said the time is now, but it will require regional buy-in and a sales tax hike of 1 cent. The council is on board with this, or are they trying to pursue seeing what other cities and towns around the area think before they say okay?
I think the council, the majority of council, is on board. There are some dissenters. Ed Driggs, one of the two Republicans, has said repeatedly that he thinks there is a need for an ambitious transportation plan, but he doesn't think this necessarily is the one. So there are arguments and subplots, but essentially I think council is largely on board. The problem is what you just mentioned, Mike. Some of the surrounding towns, there is skepticism from leadership in the legislature, and there is some skepticism from members of the local state legislative delegation. So that is where the city has to go next and figure out if they can find some consensus.
And the reason the legislature plays into this is they have to give permission to raise the sales tax to the 1 cent degree, because we only have a quarter cent left to play with before we have to go to them for permission. And it does require buy-in from the towns around Mecklenburg, particularly the northern part of Mecklenburg, which voted for the last sales tax hike for transit, but then saw no benefit because the Red Line, the proposed commuter rail to Huntersville, Cornelius, and Davidson, never materialized, mostly because they couldn't get right-of-way permissions from Norfolk Southern. They own that rail line. This week, however, former Huntersville Mayor Jill Swain wrote an op-ed piece in The Observer pushing her support for this plan. At the same time, Mayor Lyles received a letter from the mayors of Huntersville, Cornelius, and Davidson highlighting ongoing concerns. What are those concerns?
Essentially what you just said, which is they've been paying into a tax for 20, 22 years, and they feel like they've gotten nothing in return. There is no commuter line. There really is no tangible likelihood of that line being built anytime soon. They also would like bus rapid transit. They're not, they have not reached their destination on that one either. And there is no guarantee of any kind that North Mech is going to get much in the way of construction as part of this 10-year plan, which is what Charlotte Moves consists of. And remember, when you're talking about $8 to $12 billion and you're paying part of that tax, you're probably going to want to see something for your investment.
But Eric, they got the toll lanes.
I apologize. I'm sorry.
Council also pondered staggered terms and term limits and pay raises, things that have been discussed in the past to no avail. They are looking at 4-year as opposed to 2-year terms. What's the mood of council on that?
It seemed they threw out, there were I think 6 recommendations from this Citizens Advisory Committee. They threw out half of them, including term limits, nonpartisan, and some redistricting. The pay raise, the staggered terms, and the longer terms, they seem to be interested in. So I would think you're going to see those move forward. Now, the term piece of it will likely go to a voter referendum, so it'll be up to the voters. The pay raise, they can do without voter approval, and the city manager is exploring that now.
And the mayor told me that the term limit portion of this is forbidden by the state. So that's a moot point. But the proposals were put forward by a Citizens Advisory Committee, and it included, as you said, pay raises, which amount to, I think, 100. I'm going to really go out on a limb here with numbers because I'm like you, Eric, challenged. But I think a pay raise to put the city council on par with what they're paying county commissioners, including a raise for the mayor, amounts to about $193,000+ a year, yeah, in a budget that is in the hundreds of millions, I think. So it's not that much, it would seem to me, correct?
Yeah, it's not that much. It would take them up to about $50,000 per council member and $58,000 for the mayor, and that's salary and expenses and a couple of other things. Mike, this is going to be completely about a political argument, how it looks, what voters are thinking, yeah, while you're in the middle of a pandemic. That's where the argument is going to come.
But they, you know, I'm just going to jump in and just say, I mean, sure, I think there's a lot of good arguments in favor of them making more money. You know, the old way of the part-time job that pays so little, you could make a really good argument, is very restrictive in terms of who can serve. You know, that really limits it to people who've already made their money and are late in their careers. And remember, you know, the county, I remember it was a year, 2 or 3 years ago, 4 years ago, they just kind of just gave themselves a pay raise. It was a big story for about 2 days, and then it was gone.
Everybody forgot.
Yeah. Everyone forgot. And this one, if they raise their pay, I can't see this being a huge issue in the fall.
Right now, and we'll talk about this with the mayor on Tuesday, but right now the mayor makes $45,912 a year. When I told her that, she was surprised. council members make $34,546. And if you put them on a par with what they're paying the head of the county commission and the fellow commissioners, the county commission chair makes $58,000 a year, and the commissioners make $50,000 a year. And these people really don't work part-time. Most of them, they're really working all the time. The mayor, by the way, is not in favor of nonpartisan elections. And she says that even though the example has been brought up that other cities and towns around the state, that's how they do it. We're a big city, and most big cities do not. Well, before we move on, I'm just being told that Councilman Tariq Bokhari on Facebook just says he just learned that Representative John Torbett has been assigned a change in leadership in the NCGA and is no longer chair of transportation. This will have significant consequences to the headwinds in the face of the Charlotte Moves path through the General Assembly. You're nodding about this. So, Eric, the NCGA is what?
That's the state legislature, the North Carolina General Assembly. General Assembly, yeah.
And what does it mean that John Torbett has been
assigned? Well, he was at least initially seemed to be pretty open to this. He has been a longtime power broker, influential in terms of transportation in the legislature, so that could pose challenges. Well, let me make one other note, Mike. There was a meeting between the mayor and the council with the local delegation. It's 17 members. There's one Republican, Representative John Bradford, and he was the only one who didn't participate. So that's another example of the work they still have to do in terms of that state delegation.
Well, COVID cases are not going away. In fact, they're multiplying exponentially. They're continuing to rise. We're now seeing the holiday spike. That has led Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris to insist that, quote, immediate action on the part of the community is needed. She issued a directive encouraging county residents to stay home except for essential activities for the next 3 weeks through February 2nd.
If we as a community can stick to these recommendations for the next 3 weeks, we believe it will help us get our numbers back under control so that we can get more people vaccinated and start moving in the right direction with this pandemic.
Well, we remain in phase three. We have a 10 p.m. curfew in place. Glenn, despite that, how bad is this becoming here, and how does this directive help?
That's an excellent question. I guess to answer the first part of that, how bad is it? I think you summed it up. The number of confirmed COVID-19 cases has increased exponentially. I think from an average of about 100 per day back in, I think she said September, to about 900 today. That is a huge increase. How much this directive is going to do is anyone's guess. It doesn't carry the weight of law, so people can ignore it if they choose to. And frankly, we feel that for the most part, most people will ignore it.
Well, I mean, the directive includes asking residents to leave home only for essential activities, remaining home between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m., avoiding gathering with individuals you don't live with, avoiding non-essential travel, quarantining, getting tested if you've been exposed to COVID or have symptoms, and wearing a cloth face covering, practicing social distancing, and washing hands frequently. This is absolutely no different from what we've been hearing now for months. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing repeatedly and expecting a different result. What's up?
Well, I think conscientious people have been doing those things already, in all fairness.
Yes, the conscientious people are, but it's still going up, which means there's a whole bunch of people who are not. And if you don't put the weight of law behind it or fines or something, is their behavior going to change?
Unlikely. I just don't, and I don't think there is the political will to go back to a mandatory lockdown, if you will, where you're telling businesses they have to shut down or kind of going back to that. You know, that has really hurt our economy. That's hurt the regional economy, it's hurt the national economy. And while it might be necessary, we are talking about people who are, we are talking about officials who, to some degree, at least, have to answer to the people.
And let me stop you there, because I have to stop you there, Glenn. We'll come back to talk more about this in just a second at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Ann Doss Helms and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. We were talking about Gibby Harris's new directive, which is pretty much the same as the old directive, about avoiding contact and staying home to make sure that COVID cases don't continue to increase at the rate they are increasing, which is alarming. She also advised people to use virtual options for work and school.
It does not make sense to bring kids back into the schools at this point.
But this was an about face from what she said just the day before.
We believe that the schools are in reasonable shape to be able to handle the number of children that they were seeing in December based on the experience they had from that, what they learned, and what we were seeing in terms of cases.
Why the change, Eric?
Well, there were a lot of questions this week about that. You know, the Mecklenburg County, including Gibby Harris, they did three different media availabilities this week. So there were a lot of questions, and to their credit, they were answering those questions. What she said was that when she saw the numbers that came out on Tuesday, that included the 900 cases a day, the average going up again, that they just felt like they had to take a more drastic step, not because of what was going on in the schools, but what was going on in the community that could get into the schools. So that's the answer. And parents, as Ann can painfully attest, are very divided about those opinions.
Yes, Ann, we're going to talk about the kerfuffle that this has caused at the school system. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the big question is, certainly those numbers were there. You know, when CMS set 100 cases per 100,000 residents over a 7-day period as sort of its danger zone. They said, well, it's not an automatic trigger, but I think if you had said at the time, well, what if it gets 300, 400, 500 and keeps climbing, everybody would have been like, oh yeah, that's a problem. It's at 569 now in Mecklenburg County. So yes, the numbers are there, but the signal had been, you know, we were kind of the frog in the boiling water. Oh, we can do this, we can do this. So yeah, I think the big question is why seeing these numbers, knowing that everybody was going home for Christmas break, for winter break, coming back, why the health department didn't get all school officials, higher education, charter schools, private schools, CMS together and say, let's run through some scenarios. If it looks like this, you know, maybe we move ahead. If it looks like this, maybe we pull back. And instead, Ernest Winston apparently got one day's notice of some sort. Other higher ed and charter school and private school folks literally found out about it when the rest of us did and had to kind of immediately reverse gears.
Steve, I was going to say, I think what I've heard from some parents is a bit of frustration that, you know, leading up to this week, the health director had always said that her role was just to kind of give guidance and not to make recommendation and not to really put an opinion out there. And if you go back to the late summer, right before school started, you know, there were the private emails that came out where she thought kids should be in school and did not say that and would not go that far. And I think looking back, you look at August, September, October, November is 4 months that with low community spread where kids could have been in school and no one was really willing to step up and say that definitively. And then, you know, I think you could make a very good case. This was the right call. But it could have also been the right call just to say back in the fall, just to say publicly what she said to her colleagues in those emails. Kids should be in school.
Eric.
One note going back to what Ann said and about the sort of gradual boil. There are two measurements they're looking at. It's the cases per 100,000 and it's the positive test rate. And Ann was just talking about the numbers have gone up steadily in both. But I mean, particularly when you look at the positive test rate, which is creeping up around 16% now, I mean, it was 10.5% in December. This is not, yes, it's going up, but it was already well, well above the sort of code red level that the school board has established to make this decision.
So this took the school board and the superintendent by surprise because they were going to meet earlier this week and outline their plans, and then they canceled that meeting and they had an emergency meeting to discuss what to do in light of this directive that the county health director put out. And he asked Ernest Winston, the superintendent, asked the board to extend remote learning, but not because the schools aren't prepared.
We're not here because CMS is not ready. From a staffing or from an operational standpoint to bring kids and staff back into our building. That's not why we're not here. We're here because our partners at the Mecklenburg County Public Health Department, our good partners, say that our community is not ready at this time.
But as we've all been talking about, this was not really a surprise. I mean, the numbers have been out there for everybody to see. And doesn't this fall in line with the community health guidelines that the system said it would use and from the very beginning?
It does. And people who have been concerned about this have been furious at CMS for setting these guidelines and then essentially ignoring them. And that was one of the things we heard. They didn't actually cancel their regular meeting. They held it but didn't take a vote. And you had 70 people lined up to make public comments. Those are numbers that you normally see only for student assignment. And right. A lot of them were saying, we did not sign up for full remote. You know, you had the option to say for second semester, I want my kids to be in remote no matter what. I don't want them going back. And several parents stepped up and said, well, I wanted my kids to go back when it's safe, but you defined safe as these levels down here. Now we're way up here and you're saying you're going to bring them back. You know, that's we aren't comfortable with that. So that was one of many concerns that they heard in that 2.5 hours of public comments.
So the board voted to delay 8-1. The one no vote came from Sean Strain, who evidently rubbed his colleagues the wrong way by suggesting that the superintendent was being subservient to county health officials.
Even if you were going to kiss the ring and say, you know, yes, ma'am, Gibby and Dr. Sullivan and the others, you know, we want to do our part for the community.
put this comment into context, Anne, because I'm not sure I understand it. It sounds like he's objecting to following the science.
He is objecting to following Gibby Harris, and he feels like he has science. And there is, this is really often a case of dueling studies. There are real legit studies out there that say schools are safer than most places. Schools are not causing the spread. So this is really one of those two Americas perception things, because there were people who saw him as the lone voice of reason there, that he was firmly, emphatically making the case that kids need to be back in school. There were also a lot of people who felt like he was being disrespectful to the superintendent and to Gibby Harris. This idea that going along with a suggestion is kissing the ring, you know, being subservient to an authority. And that kind of echoes this whole political divide that we see. But Rhonda Lennon, who is the only other Republican on the school board and who is often on the same side of Sean Strain saying we need to get these kids back, she really took offense at the way he spoke about Gibby Harris in that way, and said that he needed to stop that, that his comments were offensive.
So the bottom line here is what? The schools will be virtual until when?
The earliest that they will bring back the younger kids would be February 15th. And what they have said is this whole kind of surprise, let's, you know, reverse course in a few hours is not going to happen. And one of the controversial things they did was not bring them back the minute that Gibby Harris's directive expires, but say, when it expires, we're going to sit down and we're going to meet with the health department. I hope some other educational entities will be involved too. We're going to look at the numbers. And on the February 9th meeting, we're either going to say, wow, things look better, let's start bringing the kids back, or sorry, it's still bad, we need to extend virtual learning.
CMS is also suspending most in-person sports extracurricular activities as well as before and after school programs. They're stopping the use of their buildings for community activities as well. How is this impacting the private schools?
Well, I think a number of them immediately pulled out of in-person learning the day of that announcement, you know, the day following her announcement. And I don't, it's very hard to track all of the private schools because they are now in application season. So you better believe there is not COVID stuff posted prominently on their website. They want people to know how wonderful they are, not that, you know, they're dealing with COVID. But at least some of them have said, no, we're not going to keep everybody home for this time. We're going to keep the younger kids in. We're going to bring some kids back a little earlier than you said. So I think it's all over the board.
So I believe this has impacted CPCC. I think they made a decision to be virtual for the foreseeable future. I think Queen's University.
They made that decision. And then when Gibby Harris clarified that this was not a mandate but a suggestion, they went back to their original plan, which is still that a number of classes are online, but their hands-on stuff, their, you know, their health sciences, their culinary stuff is going to be in person.
But it did impact Johnson C. Smith University, Glenn.
Yes, absolutely. I don't know if the directive was the deciding factor, but this week Johnson C. Smith did decide that they would keep students home and go with online classes through the rest of this school year. So you will have students who will go through their entire freshman year at Johnson C. Smith having never set foot on the campus. I talked with the president yesterday, and he said it was a difficult decision, but he said he felt it was the right decision given the level of spread and given the disproportionate impact on the Black community.
Every time we talk about COVID and the rising numbers and what the efforts being made to stop it, it becomes readily apparent that the frustration arises from conflicting messages and from no coordinated response. And that means from the federal government, it means from the state government, it means from areas. Because, Anne, you said off the air, it is worth noting that life doesn't stop at county lines, and caseloads are even higher in surrounding counties, which remain pretty open. So even though Gibby Harris may issue a directive, and even if she put teeth into it, people come and go. So it may not even work. But there have been guidelines set up, particularly within CMS. They had that dashboard that they released about the red zone and the numbers. If it crossed this line, we're not going to do this. But they do it. And one parent, Jossie Sweeney, took them to task for the will-they-won't-they approach over returning to classroom teaching.
The inconsistency and constant scrambling of last-minute decisions and switching around with emergency meetings is taking a major toll on families and teachers.
So when the superintendent decided that they're going to be out of class till February the 15th, and even if Gibby Harris decides to move on and lessen the restrictions, they're going to wait to see what really happens here. Are they listening to themselves on the board? Are they listening to Gibby Harris? Are they listening to parents, Anne?
Well, what they said was, we hear this and we understand this. We would love to not have to keep coming back and having emergency meetings and changing our plans. But there are a whole lot of things to take into account, including the fact that there are employees whose jobs depend on students being on buses or in classrooms. And they said, we have COVID relief money right now. We can extend leaves. We found alternative assignments for a lot of them. But the ones who just don't have a job, we're going to be able to pay them through this period. But we're not sure we can keep doing that forever. And so there were people who were saying, just shut us down for the third quarter. Just stay in remote third quarter. I should admit, they're not shut down. They are, do have learning going on.
Right.
Durham actually decided to do that through the whole rest of the school year. Wake County did exactly what CMS did, which is, you know, stay remote until mid-February and size things up again. But that's one of the factors, is if you just say, we're not going to do remote learning, or we're not going to do in-person learning for a long period of time, you could be looking at furloughs or layoffs.
One of the things that will hopefully help schools and everybody else, businesses, et cetera, to return to normal is getting everyone vaccinated, but that's not working out very well. It was 4 weeks ago that a Charlotte doctor became the first person in the state to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. The federal government has since shipped 1 million doses to North Carolina, but we seem to be lagging in terms of getting shots into arms. We've only administered about one third of our allotment. Why?
Depends who you ask. There were a lot of people. There's a lot of conversation. There are dueling press conferences and media appearances from the state and local officials. There is talk about what the federal government has done and the complications. There's talk about everything from data entry to having enough people to give the shots to how long it takes to give the shots. So there's also the issue of not knowing how many doses you're going to get from week to week. Mecklenburg County, when they went through their numbers, Dr. Meg Sullivan and Gibby Harris has administered most of what it has, but it doesn't have a lot. I think it was 5,200 shots that they have administered so far.
And evidently, North Carolina is 37th out of 50 in terms of distributing. West Virginia has administered 70% of their doses. Texas, Florida, and New York are also ahead of us, even though they have a higher number of people to deal with. And the finger pointing has begun. In Raleigh, the state's top health official, Dr. Mandy Cohen, lawmakers told her that the state lacks organization, flexibility, and needs to give better instructions on how to administer. Is that a fair criticism? Good.
Go ahead, Steve. Steve looks like he's going to answer. Go ahead.
No, I think there's some fairness in that. I mean, some of the states you mentioned had Texas and Florida had kind of a very simple plan from the get-go of just vaccinating by age and not breaking things down by essential workers and this and that. Just kind of a very clean process. And I think it's worth noting too that we've kind of moved on from testing, but North Carolina has never been particularly good at, when you compare it to other states, and getting people tested for COVID. We're still below average in that, even though it's not super hard to get a test today. We do not excel at that either. So, and that's been the case throughout the pandemic.
And yet, in the face of the difficulty getting the vaccines out, the state yesterday unveiled its new group plan for the COVID-19 vaccine rollout. Group one, healthcare workers and long-term care staff and residents, and group two, anyone 65 or older, are now eligible to get the vaccine. They're planning to open these mass vaccination centers on the west side at Bank of America Stadium, Charlotte Motor Speedway. I hope this is not a pipe dream. I hope they can actually accomplish this, and I hope that people trust the vaccine enough to take it. There are issues with that, which we don't have time to talk about. Glenn Berkins from QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Andos Helms, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.